Jennings goes to school. Jennings uses his head. Jennings spent most of Saturday morning with his fingers crossed. So many obstacles had arisen to block his path to the second 11 that he could hardly believe that they had been successfully overcome. Now, however, there was nothing to stop him from realizing his ambition. All the same, he was on his guard lest fate should intervene with another cruel blow. His usual method of going down to breakfast was to take the stairs two at a time, but today he walked sedately in case a chance slip should result in a sprained ankle. At 2:30, the Bracebridge team arrived. The home team was already on the pitch, wearing quartered shirts of magenta and white. It was soon obvious that the teams were evenly matched, but to start with, both sides were keyed up, with their nerves sharpened by the importance of the occasion. As a result, during the first 10 minutes, both goals were bombarded with shots, some lucky, some wildly impossible. Gradually, however, nerves were steadied, and the play improved. Tactics and skill replaced brute force and ignorance, and the spectators on the touchline shouted encouragement. Loudest of all the school supporters was Mr. Wilkins. It was as though he kept an amplifier in his throat for these important occasions, and as he swept up and down the touchline, his tremendous encouragement surged out across the pitch so that the players had difficulty in hearing the referee's whistle. In contrast to this, Bracebridge had only the thin and reedy tones of Mr. Parkinson to urge them on, and their linesman, who, owing to his role, should really have been impartial. But he was an opportunist, and carefully waited for the lulls between the shouts for Linbury to squeak, "Play up, Bracebridge!" at the top of his voice. All through the first half, the battle raged evenly, and neither side scored. Jennings was playing a hard game, but he knew that he was not playing his best. As it was his first match, and he was so much younger than the rest of the side, his sense of nervousness would not wear off. Desperately, he sought to make up in energy what he felt he was lacking in control. His first chance came in the second half, and he missed it. Linbury were attacking, and a pass came to him from the left wing. The goalkeeper was out of position, and Jennings, with the ball coming straight towards him, was unmarked less than 10 yards from the goal. Even Derbyshire could not have missed such an easy shot, and had Jennings been content to direct the ball gently into the net, he would have scored. But the sight of the open goal filled him with the overwhelming desire to drive the ball with net-severing force. He drew back his right foot, swung it forward with all his might, and missed the ball completely. Johnson was just behind him, cool-headed and capable, and avoiding the floundering Jennings, he trapped the ball dead and casually propelled it into the net. The whistle blew, 1-0. The crowd on the touchline went wild with delight, while Mr. Wilkins, as excited as the youngest of them, shouted, "Goal! Jolly good shot!" with such volume that Mr. Parkinson, who was standing nearby, decided to watch the rest of the match from the other side of the pitch. He departed, gently massaging his ear. Jennings tried hard to make up for his lapse, and for the next few minutes he played an inspired game. "Well, I'm doing all right now, anyway," he told himself, and then he proceeded to make his second unforgivable blunder. The Bracebridge forwards were pressing hard now, eager to level the score, and Jennings dropped back to his own penalty area. "Get up the field," Johnson told him. "You're miles out of position." Jennings took no notice. He would show them how well he could save a desperate situation, and no one could blame him for being slightly out of place if he stopped the other side from scoring. He was standing by the side of the goalkeeper when the Bracebridge centre-back kicked the ball towards the goal. It was never meant to be a shot, and it was not even a good pass, for the ball bounced slowly towards the goalkeeper, and Parslow would have had no difficulty in catching it waist-high and clearing to the wing. He was already cupping his arms to take the ball when Jennings leapt in front of him and attempted a clearance kick. He was not quite quick enough, however, for instead of taking the ball fairly on his instep, it glanced off the side of his boot and was deflected in a wide curve into the corner of the net. The whistle blew. 1-1. The groan that rose to the lips of the spectators was silenced by the headmaster's reproving stare, and, as in duty bound, a tepid clapping of gloved hands was just audible above the delighted squeaks of the Bracebridge linesman. Jennings had never felt so unhappy in his life. It was an accident, certainly, but a stupid, clumsy sort of accident that would never have happened if he had kept his place and not tried to interfere. Nobody said anything, but their silence was so eloquent that he squirmed with embarrassment as he took his place for the restart of the game. Both sides were playing grimly now. There were only a few minutes to go, and the level score urged them to play as though their lives depended on it. On the touchline, Derbyshire, with notebook in hand, was wondering what to write next. As self-appointed sports reporter, he wanted to give his friend a good press notice, but it was straining the bonds of friendship to have to lavish praise on one who was so obviously responsible for disaster. He consulted Atkinson and showed him what he had written. "On the last Saturday of term," Atkinson read, "a massive crowd gathered on the touchline to witness a gargantuan struggle when we played Bracebridge School in the Royal and Ancient Sport of Kings, as it is called, known as association football, better known as soccer. We won the toss and chose to play down the incline, although it is not so much of a one, and you can hardly call it a slope." "It's all right up to there," said the press correspondent, "but in the next para, I call Jennings the doughty pivot of the team. Here, look, just after this bit about the ball being literally glued to his flashing feet." "What's a doughty pivot?" demanded Atkinson. I'm not sure," Derbyshire replied, "but I got it out of a newspaper, so it's bound to be a really stylish way of saying he's good. And now he's gone and made that frantic bish and scored a goal against us." "Well, why not leave out all that about the glue on his feet and say that Jennings would have been a pivot if he hadn't made a bish? Carter's looking at his watch. It must be nearly time." "Yes, I suppose I..." "Well, what's happening?" Derbyshire looked up as the cheers of the spectators rose to a roar, for in the last minute of the game, Jennings had found his form. Intercepting an opponent's pass, he was off down the field, dribbling the ball so brilliantly that Derbyshire's reference to his flashing feet seemed almost credible. He swerved right and left through the Bracebridge forward line and left the attacking halfback standing helpless and defeated. The Linbury forwards sprinted down the field in his wake, but they'd been hanging back, and Jennings was now a good 20 yards ahead of his colleagues. With a deft flick, he pushed the ball round the Bracebridge fullback and was away again with only the goalkeeper to beat. For a moment, the goalkeeper hesitated, started to rush out, changed his mind, and retreated between the posts. Jennings bore down on him, every line of his body expressing determination. In the 59th minute of the 11th hour, his chance had come. One sure, swift shot, and he would have made atonement for his disastrous mistake. The touchline seethed with excitement, but Jennings was oblivious to everything except the ball at his feet and the agitated goalkeeper ahead. He steadied himself and drew back his foot for the shot of a lifetime. He could not miss. He could. The goal was 7 feet high by 21 feet wide. The goalkeeper was 4.5 feet high and 1 foot wide. It was a pity that, with nearly 150 square feet of goal mouth yawning like a cavern before him, Jennings had to direct his shot straight at the small figure hopping nervously in the middle of the goal. The goalkeeper cannot be said to have saved the shot, for he was too agitated to be capable of skillful movement, but his presence on the goal line was sufficient. The ball hit him fairly on the right knee and soared upwards over the bar. Jennings did not hear the groans of the spectators. He stood stock still, unable to believe his eyes. But the damage was done, and the whistle had sounded for a corner kick. Why, oh, why did he have to go and throw away the chance of a lifetime? He could have kicked himself. Now, of course, there would be no time to make good the damage, for Mr. Carter was looking at his watch and would blow the final whistle immediately after the corner kick had been taken. There was nothing more to be done. He had had every chance to justify his place in the team, and he had failed. A despairing silence gripped the spectators as Nuttall, on the right wing, prepared to take the corner kick. Derbyshire put away his notebook and looked up to watch the last kick being taken. He caught sight of Jennings, and his heart was wrung by his friend's expression of woe. Unmindful of the fact that you do not cheer when the ball is out of play, he suddenly broke the silence by shouting, "Never mind, Jennings. Better luck next time." Nuttall was just running up to take the kick when Derbyshire shouted, and at the sound of his name, Jennings turned his head for a split second towards the spectators on the touchline. Thus it was that he did not see the ball hackling towards his head until it was too late. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw an object about to hit him, and, without stopping to think, he jumped to avoid it. His instinct, however, betrayed him, and instead of flinching away from the missile, he jumped right into the path of its flight. With a thud, the ball hit him squarely in the middle of his forehead and knocked him off his feet. He lay on the ground for a moment with his eyes shut while he recovered from the shock. Thus, he did not see the Bracebridge goalkeeper picking the ball from the back of the net. He did not hear Mr. Carter blow his whistle to indicate a goal and immediately afterwards blow a long final blast as a signal that the game was over. He was unconscious of the stampede of delight which swept along the touchline as 68 pairs of Wellington boots executed an ungainly war dance, while an equal number of vocal cords vied with one another in building up a roaring cataract of cheers. The first thing Jennings knew was that the entire second 11 was helping him to his feet and patting him on the back. "Fantastically well done, Jennings," said Nuttall, pounding him heavily between the shoulder blades. "A real smasher!" Jennings blinked uncertainly at the ring of smiling faces around him. What on earth were they feeling so pleased about? "Finest header I've ever seen," said Brown. "The way you leapt at it and then, wham, right into the top corner of the net." "And the force of it, too," added Johnson. "You must have put all your weight behind it, or you wouldn't have gone down flat like that after you had rammed it in." It took Jennings a few seconds to grasp the significance of these remarks. So they had won the match after all, and it was due to his alleged header in the final second. Well, it was very gratifying, of course, to be acclaimed as the hero of the hour, but what would they say if they knew that his wonder goal was the result of the most frightful bish in the history of soccer? "Well," he said hesitantly, "it's terrifically nice of you all to be so decent about it, but..." The temptation to bask in unearned glory was strong, but virtuously he decided to tell the truth. "As a matter of fact, the whole thing was just a fluke." Cries of protest greeted this statement. "Go and boil yourself," they said affectionately. "You can't fool us like that." It was all very well to be modest and self-effacing, but Jennings was surely entitled to take the credit for his spectacular shot. "It was a goal in a thousand," said Temple admiringly. "Nonsense," said Jennings. "Well, a goal in 100, then." "Oh, no," said Jennings. "Well, anyway, it was a goal," Temple amended. "Oh, well," said Jennings. If they wouldn't believe it was an accident, what more could he say? Happily, the team escorted their visitors off the pitch. "There's one thing about old Jennings," Brown said to Johnson as he splashed in the bath some 10 minutes later. "He doesn't swank as much as he used to. The way he backpedaled about that terrific header of his, anyone who didn't know might really think it had been a fluke after all." "Yes," agreed Johnson. "He certainly knows how to use his head."
Jennings Goes to School was adapted by Ed Thomason from the book by Anthony Buckridge. The reader was Stephen Fry, and the producer was Anne Hines.